Oh, ah. She gave me the feeling that everyone was getting older, passing me by. She brought me roast beef and bread to eat. Rufus had a fever now. He didn't want the tea, but I coaxed and bullied until he swallowed it. Then we all waited. But all that happened was that Rufus's other leg began to hurt. His eyes bothered him, most because moving them hurt him, and he couldn't help following my movements or Nigel's around the room. Finally, I put a cool, damp cloth over them. That seemed to help. He still had a lot of pain in his joints, his arms, his legs, everywhere. I thought I could ease that, so I took his candle and went up to the attic for my bag. I was just in time to catch a little girl trying to get the top off my Excedrin bottle. It scared me. She could just as easily have chosen the sleeping pills. The attic wasn't as safe a place as I had thought. No, honey, give me those.
They yours?
Yes.
They candy?
Good Lord, no. They're medicine. Nasty medicine.
Ugh,
she said, and handed them back to me. She went back to her pallet next to another child. They were new children. I wondered whether the two little boys who had preceded them had been sold or sent to the fields. I took the Excedrin, what was left of the aspirin, and the sleeping pills back down with me. I would have to keep them somewhere in Rufus's room where eventually one of the kids would figure out how to get the safety caps off. Rufus had thrown off the damp cloth and was knotted on his side in pain when I got back to him. Nigel had lain down on the floor before the fireplace and gone to sleep. He could have gone back to his cabin, but he had asked me if I wanted him to stay, since this was my first night back, and I'd said yes. I dissolved 3 aspirins in water and tried to get Rufus to drink it. He wouldn't even open his mouth. So I woke Nigel, and Nigel held him down while I held his nose and poured the bad-tasting solution into his mouth as he gasped for air. He cursed us both, but after a while he began to feel a little better. Temporarily. It was a bad night. I didn't get much sleep, nor was I to get much for 6 days and nights following. Whatever Rufus had, it was terrible. He was in constant pain. He had fever. Once I had to call Nigel to hold him while I tied him down to keep him from hurting himself. I gave him aspirins. Too many, but not as many as he wanted. I made him take broth and soup and fruit and vegetable juices. He didn't want them. He never wanted to eat, but he didn't want Nigel holding him down either. He ate. Alice came in now and then to relieve me. Like Sarah, she looked older. She also looked harder. She was a cool, bitter, older sister to the girl I had known.
"Folks treat her bad 'cause of Ma's Ruth," Nigel told me. "They figure if she's been with him this long, she must like it."
And Alice said contemptuously, "Who cares what a bunch of niggers think?"
"She lost 2 babies," Nigel told me, "and the one she's got left is sickly."
"White babies," Alice said.
"Look more like him than me. Joe is even red-headed."
Joe was the single survivor. I almost cried when I heard that. No Hagar yet. I was so tired of this going back and forth. I wanted so much for it to be over. I couldn't even feel sorry for the friend who had fought for me and taken care of me when I was hurt. I was too busy feeling sorry for myself. On the 3rd day of his illness, Rufus's fever left him. He was weak and several pounds lighter, but so relieved to be rid of the fever and the pain that nothing else mattered. He thought he was getting well. He wasn't. The fever and the pain returned for 3 more days, and he got a rash that itched and eventually peeled. At last he got well and stayed well. I prayed that whatever his disease had been, I wouldn't get it, wouldn't ever have to care for anyone else who had it. A few days after the worst of his symptoms had disappeared, I was allowed to sleep in the attic. I collapsed gratefully onto the pallet Sarah had made me there, and it felt like the world's softest bed. I didn't awaken until late the next morning after long hours of deep, unbroken sleep I was still a little groggy when Alice came running up the steps and into the attic to get me.
"Moss Tom is sick," she said. "Moss Roof wants you to come."
"Oh, no," I muttered. "Tell him to send for the doctor."
"Already sent for, but Moss Tom is having bad pains in his chest."
The significance of that filtered through to me slowly. "Pains in his chest?"
"Yeah. Come on. They in the parlor."
"God, that sounds like a heart attack. There's nothing I can do."
"Just come. They want you."
I pulled on a pair of pants and threw on a shirt as I ran. What do these people want from me? Magic? If Waylon was having a heart attack, he was going to either recover or die without my help. I ran down the stairs and into the parlor where Waylon lay on a sofa, ominously still and silent.
"Do something," Rufus pleaded.
"Help him."
His voice sounded as thin and weak as he looked. His sickness had left marks on him. I wondered how he had gotten downstairs. Waylon wasn't breathing, and I couldn't find a pulse. For a moment, I stared at him, undecided, repelled, not wanting to touch him again, let alone breathe into him. Then, quelling disgust, I began mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and external heart massage. What did they call it? Cardiopulmonary resuscitation. I knew the name, and I'd seen someone doing it on television. Beyond that, I was completely ignorant. I didn't even know why I was trying to save Waylon. He wasn't worth it. And I didn't know if CPR could do any good in an era where there's no ambulance to call, no one to take over for me even if I somehow got Waylon's heart going, which I didn't expect to do. Which I didn't do. Finally, I gave up. I looked around to see Rufus on the floor near me. I didn't know whether he had sat down or fallen, but I was glad he was sitting now. "I'm sorry, Ruth. He's dead."
"You let him die?"
"He was dead when I got here. I tried to bring him back the way I brought you back when you were drowning. I failed."
"You let him die?"
He sounded like a child about to cry. His illness had weakened him so, I thought he might cry. Even healthy people cried and said irrational things when their parents died. "I did what I could, Ruth. I'm sorry."
"Damn you to hell, you let him die!"
He tried to lunge at me, succeeded only in falling over. I moved to help him up, but stopped when he tried to push me away.
"Send Nigel to me," he whispered. "Get Nigel."
I got up and went to find Nigel. Behind me, I heard Rufus say once more,
"You just let him die."
5. Things were happening too fast for me. I was almost glad to find myself put back to work with Sarah and Carrie, ignored by Rufus. I needed time to catch up with myself and catch up with life on the plantation. Carrie and Nigel had 3 sons now, and Nigel had never mentioned it to me because the youngest was 2 years old. He had forgotten that I didn't know. I was with him once as he watched them playing.
"It's good to have children," he said softly. "Good to have sons. But it's so hard to see them be slaves."
I met Alice's thin, pale little boy and saw with relief that in spite of the way she talked, she obviously loved the child.
"I keep thinking I might wake up and find them cold like the others," she said one day in the cookhouse.
"What did they die of?" I asked.
"Fevers. The doctor came and bled them and purged them, but they still died."
"He bled and purged babies?"
"They were 2 and 3. He said it would break the fever. And it did. But they died anyway."
"Alice, if I were you, I wouldn't ever let that man near Joe." She looked at her son sitting on the floor of the cookhouse eating mush and milk. He was 5 years old and he looked almost white in spite of Alice's dark skin.
"I never wanted no doctor near the other two," said Alice.
Mars Roof sent for him. Sent for him and made me let him kill my babies. Rufus's intentions had been good. Even the doctor's intentions had probably been good. But all Alice knew was that her children were dead, and she blamed Rufus. Rufus himself was to teach me about that attitude. On the day after Waylon was buried, Rufus decided to punish me for letting the old man die. I didn't know whether he honestly believed I had done such a thing. Maybe he just needed to hurt someone. He did lash out at others when he was hurt. I had already seen that. So on the morning after the funeral, he sent the current overseer, a burly man named Evan Fowler, to get me from the cookhouse. Jake Edwards had either quit or been fired sometime during my 6-year absence. Fowler came to tell me I was to work in the fields. I didn't believe it, even when the man pushed me out of the cookhouse. I thought he was just another Jake Edwards throwing his weight around. But outside, Rufus stood waiting, watching. I looked at him, then back at Fowler. "This the one?" Fowler asked Rufus. "That's her," said Rufus. And he turned and went back into the main house. Stunned, I took the sickle-like corn knife Fowler thrust into my hands and let myself be herded out toward the cornfield. Herded. Fowler got on his horse and rode a little behind me as I walked. It was a long walk. The cornfield wasn't where I'd left it. Apparently, even in this time, planters practiced some form of crop rotation. Not that that mattered to me. What in the world could I do in a cornfield? I glanced back at Fowler. "I've never done field work before," I told him. "I don't know how."
"You'll learn," he said.
He used the handle of his whip to scratch his shoulder. I began to realize that I should have resisted, should have refused to let Fowler bring me out here where only other slaves could see what happened to me. Now it was too late. It was going to be a grim day. Slaves were walking down rows of corn, chopping the stalks down with golf swing strokes of their knives. Two slaves worked a row, moving toward each other. Then they gathered the stalks they had cut and stood them in bunches at opposite ends of the row. It looked easy, but I suspected that a day of it could be back-breaking. Fowler dismounted and pointed toward a row.
"You chop like the others," he said. "Just do what they do. Now get to work."
He shoved me toward the row. There was already someone at the other end of it working toward me. Someone quick and strong, I hoped, because I doubted that I would be quick or strong for a while. I hoped that the washing and scrubbing at the house and the factory and warehouse work back in my own time had made me strong enough just to survive. I raised the knife and chopped at the first stalk. It bent over, partially cut. At almost the same moment, Fowler lashed me hard across the back. I screamed, stumbled, and spun around to face him, still holding my knife. Unimpressed, he hit me across the breasts. I fell to my knees and doubled over in a blaze of pain. Tears ran down my face. Even Tom Whalen hadn't hit slave women that way any more than he'd kicked a slave man in the groin. Fowler was an animal. I glared up at him in pain and hatred.
"Get up," he said.
I couldn't. I didn't think anything could make me get up just then until I saw Fowler raising his whip again. Somehow, I got up.
"Now do what the others do," he said. "Chop close to the ground. Chop hard."
I gripped the knife, felt myself much more eager to chop him.
"All right," he said. "Try it and get it over with. I thought you were supposed to be smart."
He was a big man. He hadn't impressed me as being very quick, but he was strong. I was afraid that even if I managed to hurt him, I wouldn't hurt him enough to keep him from killing me. Maybe I should make him try to kill me. Maybe it would get me out of this god-awful place where people punished you for helping them. Maybe it would get me home. But in how many pieces? Fowler would take the knife away from me and give it back, edge first. I turned and slashed furiously at the cornstalk, then at the next. Behind me, Fowler laughed.
"Maybe you got some sense after all," he said.
He watched me for a while, urging me on, literally cracking the whip. By the time he left, I was sweating, shaking, humiliated. I met the woman who had been working toward me, and she whispered,
"Slow down. Take a lick or two if you have to. You kill yourself today, he'll push you to kill yourself every day."
There was sense in that. Hell, if I went on the way I had been, I wouldn't even last through today. My shoulders were already beginning to ache. Fowler came back as I was gathering the cut stalks.
"What the devil do you think you're doing?" he demanded. "You ought to be halfway down the next row by now."
He hit me across the back as I bent down.
"Move! You're not in the cookhouse getting fat and lazy now. Move!"
He did that all day, coming up suddenly, shouting at me, ordering me to go faster no matter how fast I went, cursing me, threatening me. He didn't hit me that often, but he kept me on edge because I never knew when a blow would fall. It got so just the sound of his coming terrified me. I caught myself cringing, jumping at the sound of his voice. The woman in my row explained, "He's always hard on a new nigger. Make him go fast so he can see how fast they can work. Then, later on, if they slow down, he'll whip them for getting lazy." I made myself slow down. It wasn't hard. I didn't think my shoulders could have hurt much worse if they'd been broken. Sweat ran down into my eyes and my hands were beginning to blister. My back hurt from the blows I'd taken as well as from sore muscles. After a while, it was more painful for me to push myself than it was for me to let Fowler hit me. After a while, I was so tired, I didn't care either way. Pain was pain. After a while, I just wanted to lie down between the rows and not get up again. I stumbled and fell, got up and fell again. Finally, I lay face down in the dirt, unable to get up. Then came a welcome blackness. I could have been going home, or dying, or passing out. It made no difference to me. I was going away from the pain. That was all. 6. I was on my back when I came to, and there was a white face floating just above me. For a wild moment, I thought it was Kevin, thought I was home. I said his name eagerly.
"It's me, Dana."
Rufus's voice. I was still in hell. I closed my eyes, not caring what would happen next.
"Dana, get up. You'll be hurt more if I carry you than if you walk."
The words echoed strangely in my head. Kevin had said something like that to me once. I opened my eyes again to be sure it was Rufus. It was. I was still in the cornfield, still lying in the dirt.
"I came to get you," said Rufus. "Not soon enough, I guess."
I struggled to my feet. He offered a hand to help me, but I ignored it. I brushed myself off a little and followed him down the road toward his horse. From there we rode together back to the house, without a word passing between us. At the house, I went straight to the well, got a bucket of water, carried it up the stairs somehow, then washed, spread antiseptic on my new cuts, and put on clean clothes. I had a headache that eventually drove me down to Rufus's room for some Excedrin. Rufus had used all the aspirins. Unfortunately, he was in his room.
"Well, you're no good in the fields," he said when he saw me. "That's clear."
I stopped, turned, and stared at him. Just stared. He had been sitting on the bed, leaning back against the headboard, but now he straightened, faced me.
"Don't do anything stupid, Dana."
"Right," I said softly. "I've done enough stupid things. How many times have I saved your life so far?" My aching head sent me to his desk, where I had left the Excedrin. I shook three of them into my hand.
I had never taken so many before. I had never needed so many before. My hands were trembling.
Fowler would have given you a good whipping if I hadn't stopped him, said Rufus. That's not the first beating I've saved you from.
I had my Excedrin. I turned to leave the room.
Dana?
I stopped, looked at him. He was thin and weak and hollow-eyed. His illness had left its marks on him. He probably couldn't have carried me to his horse if he'd tried, and he couldn't stop me from leaving now, I thought.
You walk away from me, Dana. You'll be back in the fields in an hour.
The threat stunned me. He meant it. He'd send me back out. I stood staring at him, not with anger now, but with surprise and fear. He could do it. Maybe later I would have a chance to make him pay, but for now he could do as he pleased. He sounded more like his father than himself. In that moment, he even looked like his father.
"Don't you ever walk away from me again," he said.
Strangely, he began to sound a little afraid. He repeated the words, spacing them, emphasizing each one.
"Don't you ever walk away from me again."
I stood where I was, my head throbbing, my expression as neutral as I could make it. I still had some pride left.
"Get back in here," he said.
I stood there for a moment longer, then went back to his desk and sat down. And he wilted. The look I associated with his father vanished. He was himself again, whoever that was.
"Dana, don't make me talk to you like that," he said wearily. "Just do what I tell you."
I shook my head, unable to think of anything safe to say. And I guess I wilted. To my shame, I realized I was almost crying. I needed desperately to be alone. Somehow I kept back the tears. If he noticed, he didn't say anything. I remembered I still had the Excedrin tablets in my hand, and I took them, swallowed them without water, hoping they'd work quickly, steady me a little. Then I looked at Rufus, saw that he'd lain back again. Was I supposed to stay and watch him sleep?
"I don't see how you can swallow those things like that," he said, rubbing his throat.
There was a long silence, then another command.
"Say something. Talk to me."
"Or what?" I asked. "Are you going to have me beaten for not talking to you?" He muttered something I didn't quite hear.
"What?"
Silence. Then a rush of bitterness from me. "I saved your life, Rufus. Over and over again." I stopped for a moment, caught my breath. "And I tried to save your father's life. You know I did. You know I didn't kill him or let him die." He moved uncomfortably, wincing a little.
"Give me some of your medicine," he said. Somehow I didn't throw the bottle at him. I got up and handed it to him.
"Open it," he said. "I don't want to be bothered with that damn top."
I opened it, shook one tablet into his hand, and snapped the top back on. He looked at the tablet.
"Only one?"
"These are stronger than the others," I said. And also I wanted to hang on to them for as long as I could. Who knew how many more times he would make me need them? The ones I had taken were beginning to help me already.
"You took 3, he said petulantly. "I needed 3. No one has been beating you."
He looked away from me, put one into his mouth. He still had to chew tablets before he could swallow them.
"This tastes worse than the others," he complained.
I ignored him, put the bottle away in the desk.
"Dana?"
"What?"
"I know you tried to help Daddy."
"I know."
"Then why did you send me to the field? Why did I have to go through all that, Ruth?" He shrugged, winced, rubbed his shoulders. He still had plenty of sore muscles, apparently.
I guess I just had to make somebody pay. And it seemed that, well, people don't die when you're taken care of.
I'm not a miracle worker.
No. Daddy thought you were, though. He didn't like you, but he thought you could heal better than a doctor.
Well, I can't. Sometimes I'm less likely to kill than the doctor, that's all.
Kill?
I don't bleed or purge away people's strength when they need it most, and I know enough to try to keep a wound clean.
Is that all?
That's enough to save a few lives around here, but no, it's not all. I know a little about some diseases. Only a little.
Well, what do you know about a woman who's been hurt in childbearing?
Been hurt how? I wondered whether he meant Alice.
I don't know. The doctor said she wasn't to have any more, and she did. The baby's died, and she almost died. She hasn't been well since.
Now I knew who he was talking about.
Your mother?
Yes.
She's coming home. I want you to take care of her.
My God, Ruth, I don't know anything about problems like that.
Believe me, nothing at all.
What if the woman died in my care? He'd have me beaten to death.
She wants to come home now that... She wants to come home.
I can't care for her.
I don't know how. I hesitated.
Your mother doesn't like me anyway, Ruth. You know that as well as I do.
She hated me.
She'd make my life hell out of pure spite.
There's no one else I'd trust, Heath said. Carrie's got her own family now. I'd have to take her out of her cabin away from Nigel and the boys.
Why?
Mama has to have someone with her through the night. And what if she needed something?
You mean I'd have to sleep in her room?
Yes. She'd never have a servant sleep in her room before. Now, though, she's gotten used to it.
She won't get used to me. I'm telling you, she won't have me.
Please, Heaven. I think she will. She's older now, not so full of fire. You give her laudanum when she needs it, and she won't give you much trouble.
Laudanum?
Her medicine. She doesn't need it so much for pain anymore, Aunt May says, but she still needs it.
Since laudanum was an opium extract, I didn't doubt that she still needed it. I was going to have a drug addict on my hands. A drug addict who hated me.
Ruth, couldn't Alice...
No! A very sharp no. It occurred to me that Margaret Whalen had more reason to hate Alice than she did to hate me.
Alice would be having another baby in a few months anyway, said Rufus.
She will? Then maybe... I shut my mouth, but the thought went on. Maybe this one would be Hagar. Maybe for once I had something to gain by staying here. If only...
Maybe what?
Nothing. It doesn't matter, Ruth. I'm asking you not to put your mother in my care, for her sake and for mine. He rubbed his forehead.
I'll think about it, Dana, and talk to her. Maybe she remembers someone she'd like. Let me sleep now. I'm still so damn weak.
I started out of the room. Dana?
Yes? What now?
Go read a book or something.
Don't do any more work today.
Read a book?
Do whatever you want to.
In other words, he was sorry. He was always sorry. He would have been amazed, uncomprehending, if I refused to forgive him. I remembered suddenly the way he used to talk to his mother. If he couldn't get what he wanted from her gently, he stopped being gentle.
Why not?
She always forgave him. Seven. Margaret Whalen wanted me. She was thin and pale and weak and older than her years. Her beauty had gone to a kind of fragile gauntness. As I was reintroduced to her, She sipped at her little bottle of dark, brownish red liquid and smiled beneficently. Nigel carried her up to her room. She could walk a little, but she couldn't manage the stairs. Sometime later, she wanted to see Nigel's children. She was sugary sweet with them. I couldn't remember her being that way with anyone but Rufus before. Slave children hadn't interested her unless her husband had fathered them. Then her interest had been negative. But she gave Nigel's sons candy, and they loved her. She asked to see another slave, one I didn't know, and then wept a little when she heard that one had been sold. She was full of sweetness and charity. It scared me a little. I couldn't quite believe she'd changed that much. "Dana, can you still read the way you used to?" she asked me. "Yes, ma'am." "I wanted you because I remembered how well you read." I kept my expression neutral. If she didn't remember what she had thought of my reading, I did. "Read the Bible to me," she said. "Now?" She had just had her breakfast. I hadn't had anything yet, and I was hungry. "Now, yes. Read the Sermon on the Mount." That was the beginning of my first full day with her. When she was tired of hearing me read, she thought of other things for me to do. Her laundry, for instance. She wouldn't trust anyone else to do it. I wondered whether she had already found out that Alice generally did the laundry. And there was cleaning. She didn't believe her room had been swept and dusted until she saw me do it. She didn't believe Sarah understood how she wanted dinner prepared until I went down, got Sarah, and brought her back with me to receive instructions. She had to talk to Carrie and Nigel about the cleaning. She had to inspect the boy and girl who served at the table. In short, she had to prove that she was running her own house again. It had gone along without her for years, but she was back now. She decided to teach me to sew. I had an old Singer at home, and I could sew well enough with it to take care of my needs and Kevin's. But I thought sewing by hand, especially sewing for pleasure, was slow torture. Margaret Whalen never asked me whether I wanted to learn, though. She had time to fill, and it was my job to help her fill it. So I spent long, tedious hours trying to imitate her tiny, straight, even stitches, and she spent minutes ripping out my work and lecturing me none too gently on how bad it was. As the days passed, I learned to take longer than necessary when she sent me on errands. I learned to tell lies to get away from her when I thought I was about to explode. I learned to listen silently while she talked and talked and talked, mostly about how much better things were in Baltimore than here. I never learned to like sleeping on the floor of her room, but she wouldn't permit the trundle bed to be brought in. She honestly didn't see that it was any hardship for me to sleep on the floor. Niggers always slept on the floor. Troublesome as she was, though, Margaret Whalen had mellowed. She didn't have the old bursts of temper anymore. Maybe it was the laudanum. "You're a good girl," she said to me once as I sat near her bed stitching at a slip cover. "Much better than you used to be. Someone must have taught you to behave." "Yes, ma'am." I didn't even look up. "Good. You were impudent before. There's nothing worse than an impudent nigger." "Yes, ma'am." She depressed me, bored me, angered me, drove me crazy. But my back healed completely while I was with her. The work wasn't hard, and she never complained about anything but my sewing. She never threatened me or tried to have me whipped. Rufus said she was pleased with me. That seemed to surprise even him. So I endured her quietly. By now I knew enough to realize when I was well off. Or I thought I did. "You ought to see yourself," Alice told me one day as I was hiding out in her cabin, the cabin Rufus had had Nigel build her just before the birth of her first child. "What do you mean?" I asked. "Mas Roof really put the fear of God in you, didn't he?" "Fear of..." "What are you talking about?"
You run around fetching and carrying for that woman like you love her. And half a day in the fields was all it took.
Hell, Alice, leave me alone. I've been listening to nonsense all morning. I don't need yours.
You don't want to hear me? Get out of here. The way you always sucking up to that woman is enough to make anybody sick.
I got up and went to the cookhouse. There were times when it was stupid to expect reason from Alice. Times when it did no good to point out the obvious. There were two field hands in the cookhouse. One young man who had a broken leg splinted and obviously healing crooked, and one old man who didn't do much work anymore. I could hear them before I went in.
I know Mas Roof would get rid of me if he can, said the young man. I ain't no good to him. His daddy would have got rid of me. Won't nobody buy me, said the old man. I was burnt out long time ago. It's you young ones got to worry.
I went into the cookhouse, and the young man who had his mouth open to speak closed it quickly, looking at me with open hostility. The old man simply turned his back. I'd seen slaves do that to Alice. I hadn't noticed them doing it to me before. Suddenly, the cookhouse was no more comfortable than Alice's cabin had been. It might have been different if Sarah or Carrie had been there, but they weren't. I left the cookhouse and went back toward the main house, feeling lonely. Once I was inside, though, I wondered why I had crept away like that. Why hadn't I fought back? Alice accusing me was ridiculous, and she knew it. But the field hands, they just didn't know me, didn't know how loyal I might be to Rufus or Margaret, didn't know what I might report. And if I told them, how likely would they be to believe me? But still, I went down the hall and toward the stairs slowly, wondering why I hadn't tried to defend myself, at least tried. Was I getting so used to being submissive? Upstairs, I could hear Margaret Whalen thumping on the floor with her cane. She didn't use the cane much for walking, because she hardly ever walked. She used it to call me. I turned and went back out of the house, out toward the woods. I had to think. I wasn't getting enough time to myself. Once, God knows how long ago, I had worried that I was keeping too much distance between myself and this alien time. Now there was no distance at all. When had I stopped acting? Why had I stopped? There were people coming toward me through the woods. Several people. They were on the road, and I was several feet off it. I crouched in the trees to wait for them to pass. I was in no mood to answer some white man's stupid, inevitable questions. What are you doing here? Who's your master? I could have answered without trouble. I was nowhere near the edge of Whalen Land. But for just a while, I wanted to be my own master, before I forgot what it felt like. A white man went by on horseback, leading 2 dozen black men, chained, 2 by 2. Chained. They wore handcuffs and iron collars, with chains connecting the collars to a central chain that ran between the 2 lines. Behind the men walked several women, roped together, neck to neck. A coffle. Slaves for sale. At the end of the procession rode a second white man with a gun in his belt. They were all headed for the Whalen house. I realized suddenly that the slaves in the cookhouse had not been speculating idly about the possibility of being sold. They had known that there was a sale coming. Field hands who never set foot in the main house, and they had known. I hadn't heard a thing. Lately, Rufus spent his time either straightening out his father's affairs or sleeping. The weakness left over from his illness was still with him, and he had no time for me. He barely had time for his mother. But he had time to sell slaves. He had time to make himself that much more like his father. I let the coffle reach the house far ahead of me. By the time I got there, 3 slaves were already being added to the line. 2 men, 1 grim-faced, 1 openly weeping,
and one woman who moved as though she was sleepwalking. As I got closer, the woman began to look familiar to me. I stopped, almost not wanting to know who it was. A tall, strongly built, handsome woman. Tess. I'd seen her only two or three times this trip. She was still working in the fields, still serving the overseer at night. She'd had no children, and that may have been why she was being sold. Or maybe this was something Margaret Whalen had arranged. She might be that vindictive if she knew of her husband's temporary interest in Tess. I started toward Tess, and the white man who had just tied a rope around her neck, fastening her into the line, saw me. He turned to face me, gun drawn. I stopped, alarmed, confused. I had made no threatening move. "I just wanted to say goodbye to my friend," I told him. I was whispering for some reason.
"Say it from there. She can hear you."
"Tess?" She stood head down, shoulders rounded, a little red bundle hanging from one hand. She should have heard me, but I didn't think she had. "Tess, it's Dana." She never looked up.
"Dana!"
Rufus's voice from near the steps where he was talking with the other white man.
"You get away from here. Go inside."
"Tess?" I called once more, willing her to answer. She knew my voice, surely. Why wouldn't she look up? Why wouldn't she speak? Why wouldn't she even move? It was as though I didn't exist for her, as though I wasn't real. I stepped toward her. I think I would have gone to her, taken the rope from her neck, or gotten shot trying. But at that moment, Rufus reached me. He grabbed me, hustled me into the house, into the library.
"Stay here," he ordered. "Just stay."
He stopped, suddenly stumbled against me, clutching at me now, not to hold me where I was, but to keep himself upright.
"Damn.
How could you do it?" I hissed as he straightened.
"Tess, those others. They're my property."
I stared at him in disbelief. "Oh, my God." He passed a hand over his face, turned away.
"Look, this sale is something my father arranged before he died. You can't do anything about it, so just stay out of the way."
"Or what? You going to sell me too? You might as well." He went back outside without answering. After a while, I sat down in Tom Whalen's worn armchair and put my head down on his desk. 8. Carrie covered for me with Margaret Whalen. She wanted me to know that when she caught me heading back upstairs. Actually, I don't know why I was heading upstairs, except that I didn't want to see Rufus again for a while, and there was nowhere else to go. Carrie stopped me on the stairs, looked at me critically, then took my arm and led me back down and out to her cabin. I didn't know or care what she had in mind, but I did understand when she told me through gestures that she had told Margaret Whalen I was sick. Then she circled her neck with the thumbs and forefingers of both hands and looked at me. "I saw," I said, "Tess and two others." I drew a ragged breath. I thought that was over on this plantation. I thought it died with Tom Whalen. Carrie shrugged. "I wish I had left Rufus lying in the mud," I said, "to think I saved him so he could do something like this." Carrie caught my wrist and shook her head vigorously. "What do you mean, no? He's no good. He's all grown up now and part of the system. He could feel for us a little when his father was running things, when he wasn't entirely free himself, but now he's in charge. And I guess he had to do something right away to prove it." Carrie clasped her hands around her neck again. Then she drew closer to me and clasped them around my neck. Finally, she went over to the crib that her youngest child had recently outgrown and there, symbolically, clasped her hands again, leaving enough of an open circle for a small neck. She straightened and looked at me.
Everybody? I asked.
She nodded, gestured wildly with her arms as though gathering a group around her. Then once again, her hands around her neck. I nodded. She was almost surely right. Margaret Whalen could not run the plantation. Both the land and the people would be sold. And if Tom Whalen was any example, the people would be sold without regard for family ties. Carrie stood looking down at the crib as though she had read my thought. I was beginning to feel like a traitor, I said. Guilty for saving him. Now, I don't know what to feel. Somehow, I always seem to forgive him for what he does to me. I can't hate him the way I should until I see him doing things to other people. I shook my head. I guess I can see why there are those here who think I'm more white than black. Carrie made quick, waving aside gestures, her expression annoyed. She came over to me and wiped one side of my face with her fingers, wiped hard. I drew back, and she held her fingers in front of me, showed me both sides. But for once, I didn't understand. Frustrated, she took me by the hand and led me out to where Nigel was chopping firewood. There, before him, she repeated the face-rubbing gesture, and he nodded.
"She means it doesn't come off, Dana," he said quietly. "The black. She means the devil with people who say you anything but what you are."
I hugged her and got away from her quickly so that she wouldn't see that I was close to tears. I went up to Margaret Whalen, and she just had her laudanum. Being with her at such times was like being alone, and being alone was just what I needed. 9. I avoided Rufus for 3 days after the sale. He made it easy for me. He avoided me, too. Then on the 4th day, he came looking for me. He found me in his mother's room, yes-ma'aming her and changing her bed, while she sat looking thin and frail beside the window. She barely ate. I had actually caught myself coaxing her to eat. Then I realized that she enjoyed being coaxed. She could forget to be superior sometimes and just be someone's old mother. Rufus's mother. Unfortunately. He came in and said,
"Let Carrie finish that, Dana. I have something else for you to do."
"Oh, do you have to take her now?" said Margaret. "She was just..."
"I'll send her back later, Mama, and Carrie'll be up to finish your bed in a minute."
I left the room silently, not looking forward to whatever he had in mind.
"Down to the library," he said right behind me.
I glanced back at him, trying to gauge his mood, but he only looked tired. He ate well and got twice the rest he should have needed, but he always looked tired.
"Wait a minute," he said.
I stopped.
"Did you bring another of those pens with the ink inside?"
"Yes."
"Get it."
I went up to the attic, where I still kept most of my things. I'd brought a packet of 3 pens this time, but I only took one back down with me, in case he still took as much pleasure as he had last trip in wasting ink.
"You ever hear of dengue fever?"
he asked as we went down the stairs.
"No." "Well, according to the doc in town, that's what I had. I told him about it."
He had been going back and forth to town often since his father's death.
"Doc said he didn't see how I made it without bleeding and a good emetic. Says I'm still weak because I didn't get all the poisons out of my body."
"Put yourself in his hands," I said quietly, "and with a little luck, that will solve both our problems." He frowned uncertainly.
"What do you mean by that?"
"Not a thing." He turned and caught me by the shoulders in a grip that he probably meant to be painful. It wasn't.
"Are you trying to say you want me to die?"
I sighed. "If I did, you would, wouldn't you?" Silence. He let go of me and we went into the library. He sat down in his father's old armchair and motioned me into a hard Windsor chair nearby, which was one step up from his father, who always had me stand before him like a school kid sent to the principal's office. "If you think that little sale was bad, and Daddy really had already arranged it, you better make sure nothing happens to me." Rufus leaned back and looked at me wearily. "Do you know what would happen to the people here if I died?" I nodded. "What bothers me," I said, "is what's going to happen to them if you live." "You don't think I'm going to do anything to them, do you?" "Of course you are. And I'll have to watch and remember and decide when you've gone too far. Believe me, I'm not looking forward to the job." "You take a lot on yourself." None of it was my idea. He muttered something inaudible and probably obscene. "You ought to be in the fields," he added. "God knows why I didn't leave you out there. You would have learned a few things." "I would have been killed. You would have had to start taking very good care of yourself." I shrugged. "I don't think you have the knack." "Damn it, Dana. What's the good of sitting here trading threats? I don't believe you want to hurt me any more than I want to hurt you." I said nothing. "I brought you down here to write a few letters for me, not fight with me."
"Letters?"
He nodded. "I'll tell you, I hate to write. Don't mind reading so much, but I hate to write." "You didn't hate it 6 years ago." "I didn't have to do it then. I didn't have 8 or 9 people all wanting answers and wanting them now."
I twisted the pen in my hands. "You'll never know how hard I worked in my own time to avoid doing jobs like this." He grinned suddenly.
"Yes, I do. Kevin told me. He told me about the books you wrote, too. Your own books."
"That's how he and I earn our living."
"Yeah. Well, I thought you might miss it. Writing your own things, I mean. So I got enough paper for you to write for both of us."
I looked at him, not quite sure I'd heard right. I had read that paper in this time was expensive, and I had seen that Waylon had never had very much of it. But here was Rufus offering.
Offering what? A bribe? Another apology? "What's the matter?" he said. "Seems to me this is better than any offer I've made you so far."
"No doubt." He got paper, made room for me at the desk. "Ruth, are you going to sell anyone else?" He hesitated.
"I hope not. I don't like it."
"What's to hope? Why can't you just not do it?" Another hesitation.
"Daddy left debts, Dana. He was the most careful man I know with money, but he still left debts."
"But won't your crops pay them?"
"Some of them."
"Oh. What are you going to do?"
"Get somebody who makes her living by writing to write some very persuasive letters."
10. I wrote his letters. I had to read several of the letters he'd received first to pick up the stilted formal style of the day. I didn't want Rufus having to face some creditor that I had angered with my 20th century brevity, which could come across as 19th century abruptness, even discourtesy. Rufus gave me a general idea of what he wanted to say, and then approved or disapproved of the way I said it. Usually he approved. Then we started to go over his father's books together. I never did get back to Margaret Whalen. And I wasn't ever to get back to her full time. Rufus brought a young girl named Beth in from the fields to help with the housework. That eventually freed Carrie to spend more time with Margaret. I continued to sleep in Margaret's room because I agreed with Rufus that Carrie belonged with her family, at least at night. That meant I had to put up with Margaret waking me up when she couldn't sleep and complaining bitterly that Rufus had taken me away just when she and I were beginning to get on so well. "What does he have you doing?" she asked me several times, suspiciously. I told her.
"Seems as though he could do that himself."
Tom always did it himself.
Rufus could have done it himself, too, I thought, though I never said it aloud. He just didn't like working alone. Actually, he didn't like working at all. But if he had to do it, he wanted company. I didn't realize how much he preferred my company in particular until he came in one night a little drunk and found Alice and I eating together in her cabin. He had been away eating with a family in town. "Some people with daughters they want to get rid of," Alice had told me. She had said it with no concern at all, even though she knew her life could become much harder if Rufus married. Rufus had property and slaves, and was apparently quite eligible. He came home, and not finding either of us in the house, came out to Alice's cabin. He opened the door and saw us both looking up at him from the table, and he smiled happily.
"Behold the woman," he said, and he looked from one to the other of us. "You really are only one woman. Did you know that?"
He tottered away. Alice and I looked at each other. I thought she would laugh because she took any opportunity she could to laugh at him, though not to his face because he would beat her when he decided she needed it. She didn't laugh. She shuddered, then got up, not too gracefully. Her pregnancy was showing now, and looked out the door after him. After a while, she asked, "Does he ever take you to bed, Dana?" I jumped. Her bluntness could still startle me. "No, he doesn't want me, and I don't want him." She glanced back at me over one shoulder. "What you think your wants got to do with it?" I said nothing because I liked her, and no answer I could give could help sounding like criticism of her. "You know," she said, "you gentle him for me. He hardly hits me at all when you're here, and he never hits you." "He arranges for other people to hit me. But still, I know what he means. He likes me in bed, and you out of bed. And you and I look alike if you can believe what people say." "We look alike if we can believe our own eyes." "I guess so. Anyway, all that means we're two halves of the same woman. At least in his crazy head." 11. The time passed slowly, uneventfully, as I waited for the birth of the child I hoped would be Hagar. I went on helping Rufus and his mother. I kept a journal in shorthand.
"What the devil are these chicken marks?" Rufus asked me when he looked over my shoulder one day.
It was such a relief to be able to say what I felt, even in writing, without worrying that I might get myself or someone else into trouble. One of my secretarial classes had finally come in handy. I tried husking corn and blistered my slow, clumsy hands while experienced field hands sped through the work effortlessly, enjoying themselves. There was no reason for me to join them, but they seemed to be making a party of the husking. Rufus gave them a little whiskey to help them along, and I needed a party, needed anything that would relieve my boredom, take my mind off myself. It was a party, all right. A wild, rough kind of party that nobody modified because the master's women, Alice and I, were there. People working near me around the small mountain of corn laughed at my blisters and told me I was being initiated. A jug went around and I tasted it, choked, and drew more laughter. Surprisingly, companionable laughter. A man with huge muscles told me it was too bad I was already spoken for, and that earned me hostile looks from three women. After the work, there were great quantities of food. Chicken, pork, vegetables, cornbread, fruit. Better food than the herring and cornmeal field hands usually saw so much of. Rufus came out to play hero for providing such a good meal, and the people gave him the praise he wanted. Then they made gross jokes about him behind his back. Strangely, they seemed to like him, hold him in contempt, and fear him all at the same time. This confused me because I felt just the same mixture of emotions for him myself. I had thought my feelings were complicated because he and I had such a strange relationship. But then slavery of any kind fostered strange relationships. Only the overseer drew simple, unconflicting emotions of hatred and fear when he appeared briefly. But then it was a part of the overseer's job to be hated and feared while the master kept his hands clean. Young people began disappearing in pairs after a while, and some of the older ones stopped their eating or drinking or singing or talking long enough to give them looks of disapproval or more understanding, wistful looks. I thought about Kevin and missed him and knew I wasn't going to sleep well that night. At Christmas, there was another party. Dancing, singing, three marriages.
Daddy used to make them wait until corn shucking on Christmas to marry, Rufus told me. They like parties when they marry, and he made a few parties do.
Anything to pinch a few pennies, I said tactlessly. He glanced at me.
You better be glad he didn't waste money. You're the one who gets upset when some quick money has to be raised.
My mind had caught up with my mouth by then, and I kept quiet. He hadn't sold anyone else. The harvest had been good and the creditors patient.
Found anybody you want to jump the broom with?
He asked me. I looked at him startled and saw that he wasn't serious. He was smiling and watching the slaves do a bowing, partner-changing dance to the music of a banjo.
What would you do if I found someone? I asked.
Sell him, he said.
His smile was still in place, but there was no longer any humor in it. I noticed now that he was watching the big, muscular man who had tried to get me to dance, the same man who had spoken to me at the corn husking. I would have to ask Sarah to tell him not to speak to me again. He didn't mean anything, but that wouldn't save him if Rufus got angry.
One husband is enough for me, I said.
Kevin?
Of course, Kevin.
He's a long way off.
There was something in his tone that shouldn't have been there. I turned to face him.
Don't talk stupid.
He jumped and looked around quickly to see whether anyone had heard.
You watch your mouth, he said.
Watch yours.
He stalked away angrily. We'd been working together too much lately, especially now that Alice was so advanced in her pregnancy. I was grateful when Alice herself created another job for me, a job that got me away from him regularly. Sometime during the week-long Christmas holiday, Alice persuaded him to let me teach their son Joe to read and write.
It was my Christmas present, she told me. He asked me what I wanted, and I told him I wanted my son not to be ignorant. You know I had to fight with him all week to get him to say yes? But he had said it. Finally.
And the boy came to me every day to learn to draw big clumsy letters on the slate Rufus bought him and read simple words and rhymes from the books Rufus himself had used. But unlike Rufus, Joe wasn't bored with what he was learning. He fastened onto the lessons as though they were puzzles arranged for his entertainment, puzzles he'd loved solving. He could get so intense, throw screaming, kicking tantrums when something seemed to be eluding him, but not all that much eluded him.
You've got a damn bright little kid there, I told Rufus. You ought to be proud.
Rufus looked surprised, as though it had never occurred to him that there might be anything special about the undersized, runny-nosed child. He had spent his life watching his father ignore, even sell the children he had with black women. Apparently, it had never occurred to Rufus to break that tradition. Until now. Now he began to take an interest in his son. Perhaps he was only curious at first, but the boy captured him. I caught them together once in the library, the boy sitting on one of Rufus's knees and studying a map that Rufus had just brought home. The map was spread on Rufus's desk.
Is that our river? The boy was asking. No. That's the Miles River, northeast of here. This map doesn't show our river. Why not? It's too small. What is?
The boy peered up at him.
Our river or this map? Both, I suspect. Let's draw it then. Where does it go?
Rufus hesitated.
Just about here. But we don't have to draw it in.
Why? Don't you want the map to be right?
I made a noise and Rufus looked up at me. I thought he looked almost ashamed for a moment. He put the boy down quickly and shooed him away.
Nothing but questions, Rufus complained to me.
Enjoy it, Ruf. At least he's not out setting fire to the stable or trying to drown himself. He couldn't quite keep from laughing.
Alice said something like that.
He frowned a little.
She wants me to free him.
I nodded. Alice had already told me she meant to ask for the boy's freedom.
You put up to it, I guess.
I stared at him. Ruf, if there's a woman on the place who makes up her own mind, it's Alice. I didn't put her up to a thing.
Well, now she's got something else to make her mind up about.
What?
Nothing.
Nothing to you. I just mean to make her earn what she wants for a change, he said.
I couldn't get any more out of him than that. Eventually, though, Alice told me what he wanted.
He wants me to like him, she said with heavy contempt. Or maybe even love him. I think he wants me to be more like you.
I guarantee you he doesn't. She closed her eyes. I don't care what he wants. If I thought it would make him free my children, I'd try to do it.
But he lies, and he won't put it down on no paper.
He likes Joe, I said.
He ought to. Joe looks like a slightly darker version of him at that age. Anyway, he might decide on his own to free the boy.
And this one?
She patted her stomach.
And the others?
He'll make sure they're others.
I don't know. I'll push him whenever I can.
I should have took Joe and tried to run before I got pregnant again.
You're still thinking about running?
Wouldn't you be if you didn't have another way to get free?
I nodded. I don't mean to spend my life here watching my children grow up as slaves and maybe get sold.
He wouldn't. You don't know what he would do. He don't treat you the way he treats me. When I'm strong again after I have this baby, I'm going.
With the baby?
You don't think I'm gonna leave it here, do you?
But I don't see how you can make it.
I know more now than I did when Isaac and me left. I can make it.
I drew a deep breath. When the time comes, if I can help you, I will.
Get me a bottle of laudanum, she said.
Laudanum?
I'll have the baby to keep quiet.
Old Mama won't let me near her, but she likes you.
Get it.
All right. I didn't like it. Didn't like the idea of her trying to run with a baby and a small child. Didn't like the idea of her trying to run at all. But she was right. In her place, I would have tried. I would have tried sooner and gotten killed sooner. But I would have done it alone.
You think about this a while longer, I said. You'll get the laudanum and anything else I can supply. But you think.
I've already thought.
Not enough. I shouldn't say this, but think what's going to happen if the dogs catch Joe, or if they pull you down and get the baby.
12. The baby was a girl, born in the second month of the new year. She was her mother's daughter, born darker skinned than Joe would probably ever be.
About time I had a baby to look like me, said Alice when she saw her. You could have at least tried for red hair, said Rufus.
He was there too, peering at the baby's wrinkled little face, peering with even more concern at Alice's face, sweat-streaked and weary. For the first time and only time, I saw her smile at him. A real smile. No sarcasm, no ridicule. It silenced him for several seconds.
Carrie and I had helped with the birth. Now we left quietly, both of us probably thinking the same thing, that if Alice and Rufus were going to make peace finally, neither of us wanted to break their mood. They called the baby Hagar.
Rufus said that that was the ugliest name he had ever heard, but it was Alice's choice, and he let it stand. I thought it was the most beautiful name I had ever heard. I felt almost free, half free, if such a thing was possible, halfway home. I was gleeful at first, secretly elated. I even kidded Alice about the name she chose for her children, Joseph and Hagar, and the two others whose names I thought silently, Miriam and Aaron. I said, "Someday Rufus is going to get religion and read enough of the Bible to wonder about those children's names." Alice shrugged. "If Hagar had been a boy, I would have called her Ishmael. In the Bible, people might be slaves for a while, but they didn't have to stay slaves." My mood was so good, I almost laughed. But she wouldn't have understood that, and I couldn't have explained. I kept it all in somehow, and congratulated myself that the Bible wasn't the only place where slaves broke free. Her names were only symbolic, but I had more than symbols to remind me that freedom was possible, probable, and for me, very near. Or was it? Slowly I began to calm down. The danger to my family was past, yes. Hagar had been born, but the danger to me personally, still walked and talked and sometimes sat with Alice in her cabin in the evening as she nursed Hagar. I was there with them a couple of times, and I felt like an intruder. I was not free, not any more than Alice was, or her children with their names. In fact, it looked as though Alice might get free before I did. She caught me alone one evening and pulled me into her cabin. It was empty except for the sleeping Hagar. Joe was out collecting cuts and bruises from sturdier children. "Did you get the laudanum?" she demanded. I peered at her through the semi-darkness. Rufus kept her well supplied with candles, but at the moment the only light in the room came from the window and from a low fire over which two pots simmered. "Alice, are you sure you still want it?" I saw her frown. "Sure I want it. Course I want it. What's the matter with you?" I hedged a little. "It's so soon. The baby's only a few weeks old. You get me that stuff so I can leave when I want to." "I've got it." "Give it to me." "God damn it, Alice, will you slow down? Look, you keep working on him the way you have been, and you can get whatever you want and live to enjoy it." To my surprise, her stony expression crumbled, and she began to cry. "He'll never let any of us go.